independence in 1921, the response was respectful and somewhat muted, consistent with complex history. Ireland endured 8 centuries of political and military intervention by its neighbor before finally gaining its independence. But Queen Elizabeth remained head of state in the 6 countries that make up Northern Ireland, which is still part of the UK, and a point of friction for 7 years. During the violent period of late 1960s to late 1990s, known as the Troubles, more than 3,700 people lost their lives, including the uncle of the Queen's husband, Lord Louis Mountbatten, an icon of British imperialism, was killed in 1979 by Irish Republic Army bomb. Economic divide.
News on Europe's energy crisis just keeps getting worse. The negative news is so many that it has become difficult to gauge just how bad the European energy crisis really is. But there's no denying it. Europe has been hit the hardest, having the highest increase in energy prices, some of the highest inflation rates, and the biggest risk of recessions. Hi, I'm Kavit Tafoyi. Welcome to Economic Divide. Coming up in today's program, first, the unprecedented shutoff. Russia shutting down Nord Stream 1. That is sure to hit energy crisis in Europe. Also, Hungary, the Slovak Republic, and Czech Republic, 40% shortages in their GDP to drop around 0.6%, at least. Then, EU's rocky future. Full gas storage, not enough for the EU to weather it out. You have social crises that is showing its faces, along with social unrest. How bad is it going to get? 70,000 protested in Prague, one example. Then the West fight back plans, in particular Europe. The G7 price cap on Russian oil, that failed. Europe is outbidding the rest of the world when it comes to natural gas. Will that work?
As the crisis between Russia and the West continues to get worse, concerns are rising in Europe about potential violent protest, astronomical economic losses, and the possible closures of hundreds of small businesses and factories. Russia has shut down gas flows to Germany since a few days ago. The decision has increased already high gas prices and energy prices, putting further strain on Europe's energy and utility companies. Sweden says it will provide liquidity guarantees to Nordic and Baltic energy companies worth billions of dollars. Italy is also feeling the strain of record energy prices, prompting the government to announce a plan to turn down the heating in homes and businesses as part of efforts to reduce energy consumption in the winter. Britain has been dealing with soaring gas prices and a subsequent inflation.
We'll get spades in the ground to make sure people are not facing unaffordable energy bills. And we will also make sure that we are building hospitals, schools, roads and broadband. Secondly, I will deal hands-on with the energy crisis caused by Putin's war. I will take action this week to deal with energy bills and to secure our future energy supply.
When it comes to online posts on the issue of energy and the crisis that Europe is experiencing, of course, this is all in the context of the Ukraine conflict. There's a transformation that has taken place. I don't know if you've checked it out, but when this conflict started, it was a lot of anti-Russia sentiments and viewpoints against Russia, almost to the max. But now things are turning, the tide is turning, and a lot of the focus is going on to the officials in Europe and whether they should continue down this path. as you're about to find out in some of the online posts that we're going to review for you. First, the liquidity crunch has already hit some major European electricity firms, which have been pushed to bankruptcy. We took a look further into this. The electricity sector is facing a perfect storm, with sky-high gas prices hitting the margins of European power companies at a time when more than 100 billion euros in investments are needed annually to drive the green transition, according to the industry. Next up, we're about to experience a sovereign debt crisis, or crisis caused by the European energy crisis, all a capstone on the 100-year fiat experiment. Here's how I think the next 6 to 8 months go down. The next online post: we are not facing an energy crisis in Europe. We're facing a crisis of leadership. Next, if only Zelensky had implemented the Minsk agreements, no one would have died. Donbas would have remained as an autonomous region within Ukraine. Mariupol and Kherson would have been in Ukraine, and Europe would not have had an energy crisis. No U.S. inflation, and the oil price would roughly hover around $70 a barrel. And then comes the viewer comment of the week. Ha ha ha, the EU nations have to survive irrespective of what they show to the world. If they don't care and secure their own nation's interests, then they are doomed. Forget Ukraine, they are anyway on a path of destroying themselves by being America's proxy. There will be a time soon many EU nations like Germany will openly reject support at the cost of their own citizens. Notice the difference? Not too many anti-Russia sentiments in some of these online posts, reflective of many of what people are posting online. Okay, let me introduce our guests for this section of the Q&A. Joining us first is Kieran Allen. He's an associate professor at the School of Sociology. Kieran Allen, welcome to Economic Divide. Russia shutting down Nord Stream 1 gas pipeline to Europe. These are just some headlines. Full gas storage, not enough for the EU to last to the winter. Sweden announcing emergency guarantees for energy companies, facing the prospect of a war winter, and the cost of UK's winter triples. The headlines couldn't be worse, and the future couldn't look bleaker for Europe. Or,
well, obviously the future is looking bleak for the people of Ukraine. I think that Putin's invasion was totally wrong. I think that NATO have used it to try to essentially extend their sphere of influence. They've put in massive supply of armaments, which I'm totally opposed to. And the effect of all this in terms of the people of Europe, particularly the stupid sanctions policy, which, as you know, in Iran, only hurts the people generally. That policy is hurting working people in particular in Europe, the poor in Europe. I don't think it's doing any particular damage to Mr. Putin. I think that he's able to use the sanctions to condemn the anti-war movement that was growing in Russia. So I think the sanctions have been quite useless, and I'm certainly opposed to sanctions. But in answer to your question, is it bleak for the people of Europe? The answer is yes. What does that mean in practice for people? Well, I see the headline this morning in Ireland is that people will have to pay an extra 3,000 euros in their bills, and that's going to lead to huge social suffering.
Okay. By the way, the description that he used was the fact that Russia invaded Ukraine. That is up for question based on the viewpoints, but that is our guest viewpoint. Okay, let me introduce Mick Wallace now. Mick Wallace is a member of the European Parliament. Very appropriate for him to come and present his views on this program. Mick Wallace, thanks for joining Economic Divide. Europe is dealing with high energy prices. That has resulted in inflation as a consequence and many other things. How do you think people are going to be able to deal with this cost of living crisis, in particular, for example, like in the UK? Are we looking at how social protests will become a norm and this social incohesion that's going to happen as a result?
Well, I mean, already there is some unrest in England, in particular in Britain, over this. Britain is expected to have inflation close to 18% before the year is over. And if inflation goes to 18%, and if the increases in benefits and state wages is only at 3%, the working people of Britain could see a deficit of 15%, a 15% cut to their incoming pay. And meanwhile, the costs that they have to bear in order to make ends meet in their households is increasing by the day.
Time now for our InfoNews section of the program, where we review economic news from around the world. Our first item is a case of whether it's a wrong destination or not. Now, why do we question that? Because Ukrainian grain, which is the topic, is actually going to the EU instead of Africa. The Russian President Vladimir Putin has accused the West of deceiving poor nations with this grain deal. So there you go, a case of equality going out the door when it comes to the EU. Next up, a topic that has been suggested and probably will go through from the new UK Prime Minister, Liz Truss, and that has to cover the issue of fracking and a fracking ban, that is, which Britain is now intent to remove. This move is viewed as a way to alleviate the energy crisis. Okay, but what about fracking itself? Well, it is extremely hazardous to the environment, and that is something that Liz Truss and her team need to actually consider if and when they go through with that. Next item, looking at another angle to the trade war between the U.S. and China, and it is about a chip war, a possible one. China's great leap forward in chips is facing a U.S. pushback. Beijing efforts to secure dominance over critical chips are facing resistance from Washington. And finally, a topic that has been ongoing for quite some time, toxic pollution. The Niger Delta oil spills bring poverty. They bring low crop yields to the farmers as a result. And this has been going on for six decades of oil exploration, which have made the Niger Delta one of the most polluted places on Earth, damaging a lot, including farmlands.
You're listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
Time now for our in-depth section of the program. Europe's energy crisis is not going anywhere. Perhaps it is one of the most difficult challenges that Europe is facing in its history, and people are suffering as a result of this. This is our breakdown in this in-depth section on the different dynamics that's involved. First, we start out this in-depth section with a simple question. How much of Europe's energy comes from gas? Well, here is the breakdown. Different sources of energy that Europe derives its energy uses for. We're looking at gas, oil, coal, nuclear, hydro, wind, solar, and other. And as it is evident from the percentage breakdown, 34% is the highest out of all the other forms of energy. That comes from gas. How important gas is for Europe when it comes to its energy. Next up, we ask the question, which European countries depend on the Russian gas the most? Some of them is probably very alarming, like North Macedonia, coming in at 100% total reliance on Russian gas. Then we're looking at Germany, of note, which came in at 49% for its dependency, Italy at 46%, and France coming in at 24%. Of course, these percentages are varied based on the usage that we used here was from the year 2020 to the year 2021. Next up, let's take a look at countries which Gazprom has cut off supplies too. Now, this is important because it's showing a trend, more European resistance, then more countries may fall into this list. Resistance, i.e., not paying in rubles, which Russia has demanded. Poland, Netherlands, Bulgaria, Finland, Denmark, and Germany. Again, of note, Germany being one that we repeat in our breakdowns because Germany is a European powerhouse, but maybe not for long. So they have not complied with the ruble payment system that Russia has asked for. Now, this next piece of stat is very alarming because it shows the European gas storage. Now, we've broken it down from previous years and then all the way up to mid-June in the current calendar year. In the year 2019, you had 67% filled for the gas storage. Then 2020 at 77%, 2021 at 43%, and the current year, 52%. Now, that's best-case scenario, which has probably gone down because it's not being replenished. So that is a case for alarm, because when you start dipping below the halfway line, then that is something that, with no gas coming in, how could you then fill up the capacity for your emergency storage? Now, the 43% also was of note. Why? Because, well, 43% was lower when it came into the year, into the current year. Now, how will Europe deal with the way that it's coming up short on energy? And we took a look at gasoline in this case. Now, it's planned to reduce reliance on oil. It's really unbelievable, some of the steps that they have taken. And for example, now we took all the steps that was recommended by the EU. Reduce speed limits on highways, that's one of them. Work from home up to 3 days. Car-free Sundays in cities. Alternate car access to roads in cities. And from the millions of barrels used, which is about 45 million, when you do all those things, if they are done or executed, you're going to save a few million barrels of oil, maybe 4 million barrels of oil per day, which is a lot, but the big question is, how are they going to be able to do that? That is what is illogical based on what many are saying. Okay, let's get some analysis into this. Rejoining us is Kieran Allen, Associate Professor at the School of Sociology. Kieran Allen, welcome back. The energy crisis, so vast, it has affected all of Europe. Worse yet, we're looking at how it has affected the world. And GDP of certain countries obviously are diving. When you take a look at what the European leaders are doing, not only to their economies, but to their people, what do you think? And supposedly this being led by the U.S., I say supposedly because many don't believe that that is actually the case. We're also looking at conflicts that the U.S. wants to push against China, which is looming on the horizon.
Well, it is a dangerous trend. You're absolutely right there. Will leaders in Europe realize this? I have my doubts. I think that what we have is a growing inter-imperialist conflict between America, which assumes that it is leading the European Union, and the Russia-China axis. That's what's happening. Do I think the European leaders are going to retreat from their policy of imposing sanctions and isolating Russia? No, I don't. We had a recent meeting of NATO where China has now been defined effectively as a strategic competitor, a threat to NATO countries for the first time. They've described it as that. So do I actually think that European leaders are going to pull back? No, I don't. Do I think the people of Europe, through people power, which is always the way change happens, can begin to rise up against their leaders? Well, I hope so. And I think that starts on the economic level of people standing up, fighting against inflation, whether it's in Europe, Russia, America, you name it. People have to stand up against their leaders.
Okay, standing up against the leaders. People power, as he said. Let's see what Mick Wallace thinks, member of the European Parliament who rejoins us. Mick Wallace, this energy crisis obviously is very vast. You are at the European Parliament, and I'm sure you have so many debates going on as to how to handle it. But in particular, when we take a look at the European leaders, they are beginning to look like the ones who are going to be blamed for this, because this is just being taken out, it seems like, for the long term. People are getting aggravated. The economies of the countries are being hit, and you still have a looming conflict that's coming up with China. How do you think this is going to end up?
Yeah, well, first of all, on the energy crisis, I mean, don't forget that energy companies are making bigger profits than they ever made. So they are taking advantage of the current situation. We're looking at a crazy scenario now, where the EU's efforts to punish Russia is backfiring. Just how are they ever going to see common sense? Right now, we have a big problem in Europe, in the European Union in particular. We don't have strong leaders. And I would also say that the leadership of the big member state governments is also leaving a lot to be desired. But you ask me, is Europe going to cop onto itself start behaving in a more independent fashion and look after the people of Europe rather than being subservient to US empire? Sadly, with the present regime in Europe, with the likes of von der Leyen, Michel, and Borrell at Foreign Affairs, I'm sorry to say that it's hard to be optimistic that these people are going to bring any change.
The measures and rising energy prices, as well as out-of-control inflation, has caused anger and discontent across the continent. People in Germany have brought back Cold War-era Monday protests amid the cost of living crisis. And in the Czech Republic, tens of thousands of people held a massive protest in Prague, accusing the government of paying more attention to the war-ravaged Ukraine than to its own citizens.
When it comes to Russia, special military operation, plenty has been covered about the ramifications of this on the world economy, the European economies in particular. But did you ever stop to think how the U.S. benefits from this conflict? Well, we will do that for you now. First, there is the issue of U.S. natural gas exports to Europe. Russia's natural gas exports to the EU in 2021 was about 200 billion cubic meters. That equates to 81% of its total exports. Due to the Ukraine conflict, Russian gas exports to Europe will be reduced by 72.6 billion cubic meters annually, a conservative figure. Enter the U.S. U.S. natural gas can fill that gap. With production capacity set to exceed 1 trillion cubic meters, the U.S. is in dire need of buyers and can fill that gap. And here it is. Energy traders are making a killing exporting U.S. natural gas to Europe as prices soar, with some single shipments bringing in $200 million U.S. dollars. The U.S. is now sending 60% of its liquefied natural gas exports to Europe, up from less than 20% this time a year ago. One expert said, "You're not talking about a margin, you're talking about a multiplier. All in all, it's insane." So that covers the gas issue. Then comes the dollar. The value of the dollar has strengthened, especially against the euro. The reason why the dollar will be strengthened is that overall, Europe is no longer considered safe due to the conflict in Ukraine. For example, after the 2014 Ukraine crisis, the broad nominal exchange rate index for the dollar against major currencies rose 8.7% from February to December 2014. Number three on the list is the gains that the U.S. will have from the disruption caused between Russia and EU when it comes to trade. As EU sanctions continue to ratchet up sanctions against Russia, bilateral trade will shrink significantly between the two. And it's the EU that suffers. Russia-EU trade in 2021 was roughly around $282 billion U.S. dollars. Yet by comparison, Russia-U.S. trade in 2021 stood at $34.4 billion. And finally, there will be substantial profits for the U.S. military-industrial complex. Every week, sometimes more than once in a single week, more military aid is pledged to Ukraine. It was in May when the U.S. House passed the bill approving $40 billion U.S. dollars more in Ukraine aid. So much is the aid that the total, roughly $53 billion U.S. dollars over 2 months, goes beyond what President Biden requested and is poised to amount to the largest foreign aid package to move through Congress in at least two decades. So there you have it. This is what's called war profiteering. That does it for my segment of the program.
The way to describe the European energy crisis is getting close to actually calling it an Armageddon. Now, in case you didn't know, the actual definition is pretty appropriate and there's a surprise in it. I'll tell you why. The site or time of a final and conclusive battle between the forces of good and evil. That's right. The question that comes about now is which forces are good and which forces are evil. Especially when it comes to the U.S., for example. Is the U.S. the force of good when it's leading Europe down a path of economic destruction? Or is Russia the force of good or evil standing up to U.S. and NATO's aggression? Think about that. That does it for this edition of the program. It was great having you with us. We always appreciate any comments or questions. From Mikhail Tavoy and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Under the starry sky of the desert, from the very heart of evergreen forests, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains, closer, Iran,
hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. I don't know why. Eating breakfast in the nature really hits the spot. What a delicious jam. Different taste. After drinking a cup of Iranian tea, I sit up. I have the necessary stuff for an exciting adventure. And here's my backpack. Oh, listen. Very sweet. Here we have the birds singing, the beautiful nature, and a new adventure in Iran. Yes, I'm in Shirabad Park in Golestan province, and our today's destination is Shirabad Waterfall. Stay with me. Shirabad Waterfall is in Alborz mountain range in Golestan province, northern Iran. Shirabad Waterfall is in the form of a stairway cascade and includes 12 large and small waterfalls. Its largest waterfall is 35 meters high. There is a cave on top of the waterfalls. Water flows inside the cave, which is a habitat for wildlife species such as the Iranian salamander. A large part of the cave is in absolute darkness. There is a spring at the end of the cave. There are various trees and shrubs outside the cave, such as hornbeam, maple, alder, and moss. Shirabad Waterfall has been registered on the National Heritage List. Fresh air. Oh, pure oxygen. I am in the forest. There are trees and different types of herbs here. Oh, I love these ferns. Look at them. Shirabad has a very different flora. And over there, you can see maple and elder trees. Oh no! I was about to put my feet on these colorful mushrooms. You know, I'm very careful. I watch my footsteps. You should walk on a well-trodden path so that the nature will be protected. After passing the rocks, I see the waterfall. Now, here it is, the first Shirabad waterfall. However, it's refreshing. The depth of these waterfalls are different. Some of them are very deep and some others are shallow. Oh no, it's showering. Oh God. So, let me take shelter in a cave above here. So, a change in the plan. I am now in a cave on the way to the second waterfall. It is called Shirabad Cave. I am here. Thank God I've brought my headlights. Oh, sorry, bats. I disturbed you. The walls of the cave get narrower and shorter as you step forward. Oh. sighing. At the end of the cave, there is a spring. But unfortunately, I can't continue caving because I have to come back to my residence before night. I wish I had time for more exploration. The rain stopped. Here we have clean air and piles of oxygen. Oh, it's dreamy here. And the only thing which is needed now is a cup of Iranian tea.
Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Basing country issues on others is wrong. Pay attention to the domestic capacities. This is the part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the president and members of the cabinet in Imam Khomeini's Husseiniyyah on August 30th, 2022. With regards to achievements, I believe the most important thing this government has achieved is that it has revived hope and trust in people. In some cases, these efforts have also had tangible results that the people have witnessed themselves. For example, improvements in the health sector, diplomacy, and some cultural sectors have shown clear, distinct result. Some of these have achieved results, therefore people need to be shown these results. There have been results, but people need to be told about the results and the outcomes. In some cases, the efforts have made not yet come to fruition. However, it can be sensed that work is being done. To me, these things are your greatest accomplishments.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
One of the other accomplishments you've made may be seen in your provisional trips. These are truly brilliant. It is a very important matter that this administration has made 31 trips to various points across the country in just 11 months. Two deprived and remote areas and some rare things have taken place, and a deep empathy has been shown towards the people. Their problems have been mentioned and assessed in the field. This is a very important, and I shall talk about this again in the recommendations I will make that are associated with this matter. One of the other achievements you've made has been your quick response when dealing with unforeseen events such as floods and other disasters that have taken place. This speed in your actions is very important. This is of great value that an official rushes immediately to the scene whenever there is an earthquake or a flood somewhere, and they monitor and organize the relief work that needs to be carried out there.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
In the limelight.
U.S. immigration policies have forced desperate people to traverse inhospitable landscapes along the U.S.-Mexico border. We're prepared for you an article written by Peter Jung. The piece is titled, The Other Death Valley. Hundreds of migrants are dying in remote Texas deserts. Eddie Canales can't forget the moment he saw the decomposed body of a young man in his 20s hanging from an oak tree on a South Texas ranch last September. The intense heat and humidity in this arid scrubland had quickly rotted his flesh to expose much of his skeleton, which had been at the scene for at least a week. Clearly visible in a graphic image the sheriff's office provided to the Guardian was the skull, lolling to one side, and both his feet are missing, probably eaten by wild animals. According to ID documents found, the man was from Mexico. Police explored the possibility it was a lynching, but concluded it was suicide. Eddie Canales, who runs the South Texas Human Rights Center, a non-profit organization based in Brooks County, Texas, working to put an end to the avoidable harsh deaths and reunite families with the remains of their loved ones, said, "Most of the bodies I encounter are already skeletonized," he added, "but this was particularly harrowing. That image will stay with me forever." Brooks County covers almost 1,000 square miles of sparse, brush-covered sandy ranchlands, not far from the eastern end of the U.S.-Mexico border, and is at the heart of a deadly migration crisis that is seeing desperate people die in record numbers. So high is the grim death toll that the surrounding region, spanning several Texas counties near the Rio Grande, has been called the Other Death Valley. Data bears out that terrible nickname. The Missing Migrants Project, an initiative by the Swiss-based International Organization for Migration, IOM, that tracks migrant deaths and disappearances globally, recorded 715 deaths of people trying to cross the U.S. border from Mexico in 2021. More than double the figure in 2015, making it the deadliest land crossing in the world. According to a report by the University of Texas's Strauss Center, of the four U.S. states along the border with Mexico, Texas has the longest stretch and the highest number of migrant deaths. Brooks County, where authorities recovered 119 bodies last year, has had more deaths than any other Texas county over the last three decades. Don White, county deputy sheriff, said, "We're struggling to deal with all the bodies." Last year, the county was provided with a mobile morgue by the state in response to the grisly human reaping. He said, "I recently had to pick up three fresh ones in a day." Outside experts believe that the U.S. federal immigration policies have exacerbated the tragedy, forcing migrants into ever more perilous crossings and leading refugee journeys, fleeing violence, persecution, and climate disaster to an anguished dead end. Eva Moyer, an associate professor at the University of Texas studying the precarity faced by migrants, says, "The Migrant Protection Protocols, or MPP, also known as Remain in Mexico, a policy introduced in 2019 under the Trump administration, have resulted in more than 70,000 people being sent back into Mexico to wait for their U.S. court cases, often for extended periods in makeshift camps, where they are often denied basic health care and they face violence, rape, murder, and kidnappings by organized crime groups." Eva Moyer says, "The risk continues to increase. Asylum seekers in Mexico are fearing for their lives, and smugglers are taking advantage of that. They will do anything to make profit from these people. It's human trafficking at its max." The Biden administration is finally ending the policy after court battles, but it's unclear how and when things will change substantially on the ground. Alma Maquitico, director of the National Network for Immigrant and Refugee Rights, said at the same time, Title 42, ostensibly a pandemic-related health measure introduced in 2020, closing border ports of entry and allowing the Border Patrol to summarily expel migrants without asylum hearings, has contributed to the deaths in Brooks County, Texas, and beyond. Alma Maquitico said, "Title 42 has led to a rise in deaths. People aren't crossing at cities anymore, but in more faraway, dangerous areas. They are dying in the desert." Eddie Canales also pointed to the rural, arid expanse. Contrasting it with its scorching desert namesake in California, he said, "This is the real Death Valley." He added, "The U.S. immigration system has failed. The government wants to blame the cartel, but not the policy that is creating this problem. The solution is to offer an ordered asylum pathway. You could fix this tomorrow. A spokesperson for the U.S. Customs and Border Protection, CBP, which oversees the Border Patrol's 20,000 agents working between the land ports of entry, claimed the death toll was the fault of traffickers. They said in a statement, criminal organizations continue to recklessly endanger the lives of individuals they smuggle for their own financial gain, with no regard for human life. Despite these inherent dangers, human smugglers continue to lie to migrants, claiming the borders are open. The borders are not open, and people should not attempt to make the dangerous journey. Although Brooks County in Texas is about 70 miles from the U.S.-Mexico border, it has the largest border patrol checkpoint in Texas. Located along U.S. Highway 281, one of the few northbound highways along the hundreds of miles long South Texas border region, the checkpoint processes an average of 10,000 vehicles, traversing the busiest route from Mexico and Central America to the United States each day. According to Deputy Sheriff Don White, like other deterrence policies, the checkpoint, instead of reducing the number of migrants trying to enter the United States, has driven them into deadly routes. People smugglers, often known as coyotes, demand thousands of dollars to help migrants cross the Rio Grande on rafts, usually to McAllen, Texas, where they will hide in dirty, cramped, safe houses. Migrants will then be dropped off 50 miles north on sandy back roads before being sent on a days-long trek across brutal terrain where temperatures regularly exceed 100 degrees Fahrenheit during the ever-hotter Texas summers and drop below freezing in winter in order to avoid the checkpoint. According to Oscar Carrillo, a sheriff in Culberson County, Texas, which is also dealing with a surge in bodies, smugglers often send groups of migrants in camouflage gear as well as with backpacks of cannabis, allowing them to reduce the fees owed by delivering the contraband to a contact if they survive the journey. In February 2020, Oscar Carrillo apprehended a group of more than 50 people en route. Carrillo says they are given an itinerary like a cruise line, adding, "There's been a huge rise in attempts to cross, but it's a dangerous place. There are snakes, mountain lions. If they can't continue, they'll be left behind." For those who make it over the first hurdles in an attempt to reach densely populated cities in Texas, such as Houston, Dallas, and San Antonio, where they can live under the radar of the authorities, the risk is far from over. In June of this year, 53 migrants, mostly from Mexico, were found dead inside a sweltering tractor trailer on the outskirts of San Antonio, Texas, in what was the nation's deadliest smuggling incident along the U.S.-Mexico border to date. According to data from the Customs and Border Protection, CBP, since 1999, more than 7,500 migrants from Mexico, El Salvador, Honduras, Guatemala, and beyond are estimated to have died on the U.S.-Mexico border. According to Eddie Canales, most of these deaths can be attributed to heat stroke or to dehydration, who maintains 90 water stations out in the brush. He said, yet the real number of deaths is probably far higher due to limited data and a lack of support from federal authorities. Since 95% of land on the southern border of Texas and 99% in the Brooks County is private, ranchers and farmers on the remote plots, some as large as 50,000 acres, are often the ones that discover the recently or long-deceased people. Brooks County Sheriff's Office estimates it finds only one out of every five bodies. Eddie Canales says, "It's a burden that falls on volunteers. It's usually us who have to deal with the bodies." Yet Canales and his team of volunteers can only achieve so much. An analysis by the Center for Public Integrity found that more than 2,000 of the bodies of migrants recovered in the United States have not been identified. The National Institute of Justice has called the ongoing tragedy of missing persons, which leaves families unable to properly mourn, the nation's silent mass disaster.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Palestinian protesters took to the streets in the blockaded Gaza Strip following the Friday prayers to condemn Israeli raids on Al-Aqsa Mosque in the occupied city of Al-Quds. Angry protesters shouted slogans against the Israeli regime, vowing to sacrifice their lives for the sake of Al-Aqsa Mosque. The protest comes following the desecration of the mosque by Israeli settlers backed by Israeli forces. The mosque is the third holiest site in Islam. Hamas resistance movement has warned the Israeli regime against violating the sanctity of Al-Quds.
Al-Aqsa Mosque is a red line that mustn't be crossed. We hold the Zionist entity fully responsible for any attack in Al-Quds. The enemy will only open the gates of hell on itself. The continuation of attacks on the sanctity of Al-Quds will backfire on the Zionist entity and its settlers.
Israeli settlers regularly storm Al-Aqsa Mosque, a provocative move that infuriates Palestinians. The attacks and desecration of the mosque compound increase during Jewish holidays.
We salute our people in Al-Quds, and we say to them that Palestinian resistance factions in Gaza will not remain silent amid Israeli attacks on Al-Quds. We also call on all Palestinians and Muslims to mobilize to confront Israel's conspiracies against Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Palestinians have raised the alarm over Tel Aviv's plots to divide Al-Aqsa Mosque into Jewish and Muslim sections or sitting times for visits.
The Zionists have no right to be in Al-Aqsa Mosque because it's purely for Muslims since ancient times. They are trying to control Al-Aqsa Mosque, but all their attempts will be in vain.
Protesters in the Gaza Strip vowed to step up their support for Al-Quds until the end of all the Israeli violations in the Holy City. Observers say the world has failed to help Palestinians in Al-Quds while turning a blind eye to Israeli violations against the oppressed people of Palestine for decades. Ashraf Shana, Gaza.
British police have found themselves embroiled in another racism scandal, this time surrounding the killing of an unarmed black man in South London by armed officers on the 5th of September. Following an alleged police pursuit, 24-year-old Chris Carver was behind the wheel of a car hemmed in by two police vehicles in a narrow street before one round was fired, ending his life. He leaves behind a fiancée and an unborn child. No gun was found in the car.
Thousands of protesters have descended outside police headquarters in central London to vent their fury over what they say is gross injustice being carried out by the authorities against Chris and his family. Accusations are swirling around, some of which include